New York State is trying to make it easier and faster for unemployed people to find jobs. The state's Department of Labor has a new tool. It's calling it a major leap forward. It's a computer program designed to match job seekers with the employers most likely to hire them. From member station WNYC in New York, Ilya Maritz explains.
Lisa Berger is one of the very first New Yorkers to test what this computer program can do. She has a couple decades' experience as a publishing executive and more recently as a nonprofit fundraiser. Berger is self-assured, but she says being jobless for nearly a year has rattled her, and she's willing to try something new.
If there's something out there that can help, I think the environment is really bad. I have never in my entire life had a trouble getting a job like this, ever.
And so Berger has come to a job center in Manhattan. After meeting with employment counselor Emily Aponte, she sends off her resume. 5 minutes later, Aponte announces a reply has come in by email.
What do we got? We have 15 job matches that were generated from your resume. So this is an event planning, associate director of event planning.
The listings Berger is looking at were selected from the state job bank by a computer running a complex mathematical formula, or algorithm. These kinds of equations are also the key element behind Google's internet search results and the movie recommendations Netflix makes. Matt Sigelman says the beauty of algorithms is that they see patterns. Sigelman is the CEO of Burning Glass, a Boston company that developed the job search algorithm Lisa Berger is now testing.
It's actually studying how real people, by the tens of millions, get the jobs that they move into. The technology is designed to learn from past patterns of placements.
For the user, it's different from a keyword job search on Monster.com or Career Builder because the algorithm actually registers whole sentences from resumes. Sigelman says this program mimics the human activity of reading and digesting information. Coca-Cola, Accenture, and Google are some of Burning Glass's clients. Now New York State is as well. But there's a difference. The program is now being used on behalf of job seekers, people like Lisa Berger.
Let's scan down.
Okay. So vice president, group manager.
That's almost exactly what I did in the past.
Berger isn't overly impressed with the jobs the algorithm recommends. Only one really interests her. Director of strategic planning at a sports PR company. The description says this position is non-traditional.
Yeah, I liked that because they might then consider a non-traditional candidate.
And it might be a little bit more interesting.
And it also reports to the CEO managing partner. It does what I like doing best in the corporate world, which is sort of coming up with a strategic plan.
Berger says she'll probably apply, and she did learn something. If she wants to work at a nonprofit, she needs to beef up that part of her resume.
It's highlighting much more of what I used to do versus what I want to do.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest thing that I think I've learned.
Right now, Minnesota is the only other state to use this kind of fancy math to try to connect workers with jobs. There's no hard data, but a spokesperson for the state says the program has been working well. New York is trying job seeker algorithms as a one-year pilot program. If enough people say they got something out of it, the state labor department says it will make this program permanent. For NPR News, I'm Ilya Maritz in New York.
And computer chip giant Intel is the target of a new antitrust suit brought by New York Attorney General Andrew Cuomo. Intel commands about 80% of the market for microprocessors. From member station KQED, Stephanie Martin reports.
The New York Attorney General accuses Intel of bribing computer makers with billions of dollars disguised as rebates. He also says the company threatened and retaliated against those who strayed from the Intel brand. And Cuomo says this ultimately restricted consumers' access to better products and lower prices. Intel legal affairs spokesman Chuck Malloy says Cuomo is buying into a story that Intel contends is simply untrue.
Our business practices are lawful. Consumers are benefiting. Nobody pays more for a PC today than they did a year ago.
Intel is also fighting antitrust battles overseas, most notably in Europe, where last May European Union commissioners slapped the company with a nearly $1.5 billion fine. Stanford Law School antitrust professor Mark Lemley says the Cuomo lawsuit may be a harbinger of what's in store in the U.S.
The Federal Trade Commission has been investigating Intel's practices, and Cuomo indicates that he had been coordinating with the Federal Trade Commission. So it's possible that we'll see activity at the federal level against Intel in the near future.
The Cuomo lawsuit alleges Intel threatened and gave illegal kickbacks to three of the nation's largest computer makers, Dell, Hewlett-Packard, and IBM. For NPR News, I'm Stephanie Martin in San Francisco.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I am Ira Flatow. Remember when compact fluorescent light bulbs first came out? They were kind of a tough sell because they were expensive. They were too big to fit into your lampshade socket. Remember how you tried to squeeze one into that one? They needed time to warm up. Well, since then, their size has shrunk. The price has come down, but they are cheaply made and burn out quickly most of the time, at least in my house. So is there a better light bulb? The U.S. Department of Energy is willing to pay a lot to find out. $10 million. They have a contest going on. The contest is called the L Prize. And Jim Broadrick is a lighting program manager for the Building Technologies Program at the U.S. Department of Energy. And he's here to talk about it. Welcome to Science Friday, Dr. Broadrick.
Yes, good afternoon, Ira.
Good afternoon. Let's talk about the contest. A bulb is chosen. Why did you choose light bulbs?
Well, the most ubiquitous light bulb in the United States is the 60-watt incandescent. We estimate there's over 900 million of them in sockets in people's homes and in hotels today. So it uses a lot of energy, and it's a good opportunity to reduce consumption by having a much more efficient light bulb.
So tell us about what's required to enter the contest. What criteria do the bulbs need to meet?
Okay, the bulb itself, called a lamp by the lighting industry, is fundamentally a 60-watt light incandescent light bulb. If you put one in your hands, it would look pretty much the same. The color of the light would be the same. It would fit the same socket, and much is the same. The two big differences, Ira, are that they will be 90 lumens per watt relative to about 12 lumens per watt. Now, that's an efficiency number there. And the other item is that it's 25,000 hours of life compared to present incandescents at about 1,000 hours of life.
Wow. So there'll be 7 or 8 times give off as much light and much more efficient. And what candidate do you have in hand? You actually have an LED device, correct?
Yeah. Yes, that's correct, Ira. At the end of September, we received an entry from Philips Lighting to enter. They had to send us 2,000 samples because we intend to do a lot of testing. So we're really excited about Philips entering, and the contest is still open. We'd like more companies to enter it.
Mm-hmm. And most of the bulb has to be manufactured right here in the old USA, right?
That is correct, Ira. It's U.S. taxpayer dollars in motion, and we want to have benefit for the U.S. people, including jobs and energy savings both.
Mm-hmm. And so far, how many? You just have this one contestant in the race?
Right, that is correct. We have one entry, but I've been on the phone the last 2 weeks in discussions with five other companies.
It's interesting that Philips, a foreign light bulb maker, would be a contestant in an American light bulb contest.
Yeah. Yes, at first blush, your senses are right, but Philips is a U.S.-based company. They own buildings, pay taxes, and have payroll here with U.S. citizens, so they do qualify for the test.
And
and
what does it look like? Does it look like a regular incandescent bulb, shaped like one?
Yeah. Very, very much so. It has it's a little bit different than the normal pear shape. Obviously, the socket is identical. And when you put it on, as we expected, you get what's called a warm white, or it looks just like an incandescent, the light that comes off it. It appears to me to have about the right amount of light coming out of it. We will be testing to make sure that assumption is correct. And it so far looks really good.
We have a picture of it on our website at sciencefriday.com. It does look very, very interesting. And I'm surprised how uniform the light is going out in all directions on it. I always, I have an LED flashlight that sort of shines in one direction. What have they done to make it so that the light is so uniformly displayed?
Okay, well, I'm sure that's a secret, Philips. You're asking those tough questions. But fundamentally, as you're correct, the LED, keep in mind, is about the size of a fleck of pepper. And there's a number of LEDs inside this bulb. And so what you have to do is sort of aim them out in directions, and then you can aid this with little lenses, like lenses on your glasses, to further disperse it. And you want to come up with what's called omnidirectional lighting, which, Ira, you noted, it comes out very evenly in all directions. And that's not simple with these little teeny LEDs.
Yeah, and I imagine, as you know, as the first bulbs or the first devices of everything, this one would be very expensive to manufacture at this time.
Yes, the LEDs cost quite a bit more. Then you have to add electronics and the packaging, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, it should cost quite a bit more, but there are certainly some enticements. I'm sure people bought handheld calculators back in the 70s.
Right.
When you went and looked at the price of those, it was pretty amazing back then.
I remember when the first LED watches were $400, you know, for something that cost 10 cents now or something.
That's exactly. Very good, Ira. Yes, the handheld calculator back in the 70s cost, in today's dollars, about $1,500. You know, which is like, wow.
It was like wow back then,
Yeah. Well, back then it was about 400. Now it's about 15, and it did just the four basic functions.
Yeah.
Today, I don't think you can buy a calculator, a handheld calculator. It does four functions. They give them away for free at banks.
Yeah. So how will we know if and when this is the winner? What do you have to do to win
it? We're going to go through several levels of testing, and that has already started. We will be putting about 200 of these through what's called photometric testing. This is a testing lab type of thing where we find out just exactly how much light's coming out. Has it got that nice even dispersion that you mentioned? Is it the right color that we wanted? So there will be about 200 samples tested there. Then a subcomponent will be sent for stress testing, you know, shake, rattle, roll, bake them, freeze them.
Mm-hmm.
All that stuff. And the third level is lifetime testing, which will be testing for 6,000 hours, which will take almost 9 months.
So you turn them on for 6,000 hours, but they have to last a lot longer than 6,000, right?
That is correct. That is correct. The present testing method says that you do them for 6,000 hours. Of course, we'll just leave them right on the test assembly and let them run forever, basically. And then you take that 6,000 hours of test data and you mathematically extrapolate that out to be assured that you can get 25,000 hours of life. The reason 200 samples will be loaded on this test platform is because that's a statistically valid representation.
Mm-hmm. Of course, Philips doesn't need this kind of money. I mean, this is chicken feed for a big company like them, but yet they've entered the contest, I guess, to sort of stimulate, and you're happy because that stimulates interest in the LEDs.
Oh, absolutely, Ira, you're right. Philips is very interested. This is a little bit of the Olympics. Everybody wants to win the gold medal. And also we have partners. We have 27 utilities and other regional organizations that have signed up to be what are called L-Prize partners, and they represent about 100 million electricity consumers in the U.S., and they will be helping the winners take this product to market.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot more money on the table than first appears.
Are these kind of people who would license the technology once Philips creates it, or are they actually going to make the components?
Okay, the L-Price partners are utilities like Consolidated Edison. Okay, and they do a lot of things. They incentivize, of course.
Right.
They put bill stuffers, and they do joint promotional things. And so we can't commit the utilities to saying what they will do, but it's very likely they'll do something.
Mm-hmm.
And there's quite a bit of, influencing purchase power with the utilities.
I see that as the word discount.
Yeah.
You've been in Washington a long time.
Yeah, that's true.
Influencing that's purchasing. True. I like that. One quick question for you. One thing that, you know, fluorescents can't do unless you buy the really expensive ones is to be dimmed down. Can these be put on a dimmer?
Oh, absolutely.
They can.
Absolutely. Let me mention on the CFLs to help the folks out there listening is that if you have a CFL, you want to put in a socket that you have a dimmer. You have to look at the box to make sure it says that it's dimmable. Otherwise, you burn it out. Now, with the L Prize, with this replacement bulb, it's totally dimmable because first of all, we asked for it, but it's also inside the light bulb. It's low voltage DC, mm-hmm. which is very easy to dim. And since it's a digital, LEDs are light emitting diodes. They're fundamentally an electronic gizmo.
They're solid state, state light bulbs.
Yeah, they're easy to dim.
And so there's a little bit of like a battery-sized electric current in there, and you could just turn it down, and it'll proportionally dim down as you turn the knob down.
That is correct.
And was that something that was a requirement or just something that happens to be in the technology?
Oh, no. Ira, it's a requirement. It has to be dimmable, and then the submittal has to list at least three available on the market dimmers that it works very well with. Mm-hmm. So we want to have it dimmable because of people's interest in that. Plus, it's not that hard.
Yeah, I hear you. Now I know you're not a wagering person, and you can't really bet on the outcome of this. But if I were betting on it, I would think that Philips has a pretty good leg up on the competition in this contest. Would I be wrong in thinking that?
No, you wouldn't be wrong. But let me add that we are looking for three winners.
Aha.
So Philips is first, and it looks likely that their horse will cross the line, but we still want win, place, show. We want two other entries to also share in the L Prize name, the branding, and also be supported by our utility partners.
All right. So we will hopefully stimulate some interest for you, Jim.
Good, great.
And you'll get some more contestants here.
Good.
Good luck to you.
Okay, thank you, Ira.
You're welcome. Jim Broderick is a lighting program manager for the Building Technologies Program at the U.S. Department of Energy in Washington.
For 2 years, some of the biggest names in consumer technology have been trying to match Apple and its wildly popular iPhone. Apple teamed up with AT&T to market the phone, and ever since, their competitors have been working desperately to try and outcool what is widely thought to be the coolest smartphone. The latest contender came out on Friday. It's called the Droid, and I've got one in my hands right now. This phone runs the latest version of Google's mobile operating system. It's called Android. Joshua Topolsky is the editor-in-chief of the technology blog Engadget. He's been playing with the Droid for a while, and he's with us to talk about it. Hi, Josh.
Hi there.
So what do you think? Is this the iPhone killer?
No. It's not really an iPhone killer, and I'm not sure that it has to be. It's a great phone. It offers a lot of things the iPhone doesn't. And I think there's probably room for more than one smartphone.
Well, what differentiates it from the iPhone?
Well, it does a lot of what the iPhone does. You know, it's got obviously a 3G data connection. It can do web browsing and media playing, the sort of standard stuff you'd expect now from a phone. It has, they say, over 10,000 apps. You can download different types of apps, and new ones are coming out all the time. It has a 5-megapixel camera, which is much higher quality than the iPhone. The Android devices allow for a lot of customization, whereas the iPhone is pretty much closed. Apple has it their way, and that's the way it's got to be. The other thing is that it allows you to run multiple applications at once. It multitasks, whereas the iPhone does not do that. So that's been a big selling point for them.
And they cost about the same price?
The flagship device, the iPhone 3GS, is $199 on contract, and the Droid is also $199 on contract.
And now, every so often, we hear about how, you know, there's a hot new phone out there. It's going to give the iPhone a run for its money. There was the BlackBerry Storm, the Palm Pre, which actually got great reviews, but those haven't been game changers. What's different about the Droid?
I think that the combination here of Google and Verizon, Verizon's the largest carrier in America, and Google really putting its all into this device, it's unique. The Pre is a great phone, but it doesn't have the kind of huge push behind it that Google could give something. And they're a formidable company when it comes to the tech sector.
Now, Verizon, the company that's teamed up with Motorola to put together the Droid, their campaign is basically an attack ad on the iPhone. But the iPhone isn't even the number one smartphone in terms of market share. Why is the iPhone such a target?
Well, I think the iPhone, like you said, it's not the number one smartphone, but it is really the most visible. It's the phone that has really made the general public aware of the existence of these devices and brought them into the spotlight. And really, it's the cool device that everybody wants to have. It's the sort of the device to beat, even though, as you said, it's not the number one in market share.
Okay, so if you you had to buy one.
Yeah.
You had to pick one.
Okay.
Which one would you pick?
I think I'd have to go with the iPhone.
With the iPhone, okay.
Yeah, just, I mean, the app selection is enormous, and there are some elements to the types of apps you can develop, for instance, 3D gaming, things like that, that really hasn't been surfaced that much on Android phones.
Now, Josh, both you and I use smartphones. We have to use them for our jobs. But is smartphone use really that widespread in the United States at this point?
Well, it's not as widespread as the use of what we would call a dumb phone or feature phones, which are just standard cell phones. But the smart use of smartphones is growing, and it's growing at quite a pace, whereas the use of dumb phones and feature phones is on the decline. So I think this is where we're headed. I mean, in the future, in the very near future, nobody's going to have very few people will probably just have a cell phone. I think as the technology evolves and the prices come down, this is going to be what everybody has in their pocket. So it's really important to watch the market right now. This is why companies like Microsoft, who obviously have a huge market share when it comes to PCs, they're aggressively trying to get back into this game and trying to make a name for themselves again. Because, like as I said, it's wide open and it's where everybody's headed.
Joshua Topolsky is the editor-in-chief of the technology blog Engadget, and he spoke with me from NPR New York. Josh, thanks so much.
Thank you.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
I'm Melissa Block, and it's time now for All Tech Considered. What if you could power your cell phone without having to plug it in, ever? Well, a tiny Cleveland startup is close to making that idea a reality. Just put the company's personal energy generator on your belt or in your backpack, and it will charge a portable gadget as you walk. Dan Bobkoff of member station WCPN reports.
Aaron Lemieux is a pretty powerful guy.
I weigh about 180 pounds. I'm about 6 foot tall. As I walk along, I expend about 100 watts of power just to get from point A to point B.
And a few years ago, he was walking along the Appalachian Trail, just wasting all that energy, and he still had to stop in little towns to find batteries for his Walkman. For a mechanical engineer like Lemieux, this was a problem waiting to be solved.
Our mobile electronic devices, like my iPhone, only requires 2.5 watts of power to be able to fully recharge itself. So in the end, all we have to do is harvest 2.5% of your human walking energy without you knowing it and to be able to put it in your mobile electronic device.
So after years of tinkering, Lemieux's company Tremont Electric is about to launch its first product that takes a little of your walking energy and sends it to your portable electronics. It's called the Personal Energy Generator, or PEG, and it's about the size of a flashlight. Lemieux put it on his belt and took me for a walk to show off an early prototype.
So we're sort of ambling here, light, leisurely walk. If I were to do this with one of the new units going to market, would this be enough of a walk to get, like, wall outlet level power?
Yes, it would. And that's exactly what our testing is coming back at now.
With each step, magnets bounce back and forth off springs inside the PEG, generating electricity. The springs amplify its movement, allowing the PEG to make a lot more power than other past attempts at capturing kinetic energy. Sarah Bradford of Texas-based market research firm Frost & Sullivan is impressed.
As a category, it is a breakthrough that we are now starting to see commercial products such as Enpower hit the market.
This kind of technology isn't expected to go mainstream until it's cheaply built into devices we already have. Imagine a cell phone that charges as you walk around all day. And Lemieux has another idea, buoy-sized versions that float in the ocean, getting power from the waves. But for now, he's just trying to get his company off the ground and the $149 PEG into customers' hands by the holidays. Though he concedes it's not for everyone.
What would you say to someone who's a bit sedentary? Is this not the product for them?
Quite possibly it's not a very good product for them. But then again, you know, if people use a pedometer and are able to log the amount of steps that they take, what people generally find is they do a lot more walking than they anticipate.
Anne Lemieux says the weight loss is free. For NPR News, I'm Dan Bobkoff in Cleveland.
And for more of the latest tech news, we're joined, as we are most Mondays, by Omar Gayaga. He covers technology culture for the Austin American-Statesman. Omar, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And we've been talking about portable gadgets. We're going to talk about another one now, the Motorola Droid smartphone from Verizon, which came on the market recently, and you've been fiddling around with it. What do you think?
Yeah, I've been playing with it a little bit over the weekend. That's the Droid phone saying hello.
Wow.
They've really positioned this as sort of an iPhone killer. They want it to kind of go head-to-head. And I use an iPhone, so I've definitely seen what's good and what's bad of it so far. Definitely on the pro side, if you're someone who wants an iPhone and have been on the fence because you need a physical keyboard, it does have that, although I kind of hate physical keyboards. I find the keys to be way too small for my thumbs, and I end up being much more efficient typing on a virtual on-screen keyboard. The navigation stuff, Google Maps Navigator is included in this, and it's very, very good. It's a turn-based navigation that kind of rolls in Google Maps, gives you street-level views. The Verizon network, you know, a lot of people think it's much better than AT&T's network. So on that score, I mean, I didn't experience any dropped calls or any network problems. The 3G holds up very solidly no matter where I was. I think the phone design itself is a little bit ugly. It's kind of a black slab sitting on top of another black slab with gold accents, which, you know, it's a very kind of masculine metal dense in your hand kind of feel, not curvy like the iPhone. So I think it's definitely a good alternative to the iPhone. If I were shopping for something outside of the iPhone universe, that would probably be my first choice. And the Android software is very well integrated with Gmail, Google Calendar, and a lot of the services that I already use. So I found some good and some bad on the Droid.
Let's talk about another piece of technology. This one's not out yet. I guess it's supposed to hit stores just before the holidays, and it's from Dell. It's calling it the world's thinnest laptop. What does it have to offer besides a little more room in your backpack or your laptop bag, do you think?
It is the Dell Adamo XPS is the name of the laptop, and this is sort of the second generation that Dell has introduced of this line of laptops. They had one in March called the Adamo, and this is sort of the next generation of that that they took under wraps last week, and I got some cuddle time with it, as I like to call it. I got to kind of play around with it. It's very, very thin. I mean, it's similar to the Apple MacBook Air in that it's just very, very light. I think it's just a little over 3 pounds. It's 9.99 millimeters thick. There's no latch on it physically. The way you open it is you actually run your finger across it, because they said just having a latch on there like a normal laptop would have just made it too thick. So there's some very interesting design things going on. And Dell, you know, in the past was not known as a very design forward kind of company, and they're really kind of pushing the envelope on that. It all sounds good so far, but the downside is that it starts at $1,799,
which
is very much out of the range of most laptop buyers. And it also is not as powerful as laptops you could get for half the price. I mean, they definitely had to be some sacrifices on speed and power in order to fit all that in there. There's no optical drive. You'd have to get that separately if you wanted a CD or DVD drive in there. But for someone that just wants to carry that around and has money to burn, there's definitely, I think, a market for that. But I think design-wise, it's very interesting, something cool to watch.
Well, before we let you go, Omar, we wanted to talk to you about a little bit of tech culture. Disney is going to be using a video game to help reimagine one of its most beloved characters. The game is called Epic Mickey. What can you tell us about it?
Right. This is one that's kind of close to my heart, because the development of it is happening here in Austin. There's a game designer named Warren Spector, who is kind of a legend in the game industry. He's creating this game where you're playing as Mickey Mouse. And the character, which has become kind of stale over the years, I guess you could say.
No, Omar, say it's not so.
Well, it's kind of a darker take on Mickey Mouse. And Warren Spector, who's a huge Disney fan, he kind of grew up on this stuff and is obsessed with it. He wants to kind of take Mickey back to his roots, where he was more mischievous. And the game itself is going to be for the Wii, and you will actually be controlling Mickey and sort of painting this world and using paint thinner to kind of build and erase the world around you. And the concept is very interesting. It's this sort of cartoon wasteland where these forgotten Disney characters have kind of grown bitter over Mickey's success. Very interesting take on Mickey Mouse. We'll be curious to see how that turns out. It'll be out fall of 2010.
Okay, Omar, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. And we will, of course, have links to all of these items on the NPR All Tech Considered blog at npr.org/alltech.
Omar Gayaga covers technology culture for the Austin American Statesman and for All Tech Considered. This is NPR, National Public Radio.